or something. Can you get that out? Cement. Is this thing cemented in?
Mm-hmm. Can you try and take it out?
Yeah.
There you go.
Let's go.
Randomly made. Thank you.
All right, ready to get started?
Yeah. Thanks for skipping out on Kaminsky's talk and coming to see us. Really appreciate that. Just want to introduce ourselves quick. My name is Scott Urban. I do run a company called SecMedic. I have been involved in IT security for just over 15 years, with the focus probably the last 3 years on medical device security. So that's who I am. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, you can try that, or maybe get a hold of me after the talk. I'll give you contact info.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sean Berninger. I've been in security for about a little over a decade now. Worked at some big companies doing healthcare. I'm sorry, doing product security, and then moved into some consulting, and then now I do healthcare. And someone told me they were going to save my spot at the summit party. So it's still the line's still going, I think. So hopefully they'll hold it for me. God, I thought that'd get a laugh. So I also run the MedSec LinkedIn group, which is on LinkedIn. It's got about 600 folks. Anyone's welcome to join. And then I have a little Twitter account here too, which is focused on technical issues with medical devices and healthcare security in general.
All right, so first off, we want to start with, you know, why do we get involved in researching medical devices? Are we just assholes that want to call out people, or do we really have a vested interest in this and seeing that our products are more secure? So one of the big things for us, you know, we realize that the healthcare industry is behind, and this isn't just another Android bug when we get into these things. It really is patient safety consequences. With these types of device, they're made to save lives, and ultimately they do a very good job at that. But we think that security can get better, can improve, and so that's why we're looking into the research on that. And we also, we know there's a lot of healthcare organizations that this is kind of new to. As an industry, healthcare security is quite a bit behind. We'll talk about that later. But we want to equip defenders, especially in the healthcare space, and make sure, you know, that they can protect those devices. And ultimately, if you look across, you know, any healthcare organization out there, I think if you're working for one, you're going to find something inside of their missions and values, right? And this is what really got to me of how can I, you know, affect, you know, missions and values for healthcare organizations. And they're going to have something with, you know, patient safety is going to be something, one of their critical missions, one of their critical values or core beliefs that they have. And so that really came to me as how can I have a direct impact on that instead of sitting in the background, you know, as a security guy and kind of indirectly being able to help folks out on the floor deliver patient care. This is where we cross into, you know, IS security folks really having a direct contribution to that mission on patient safety for organizations. So it's kind of what we're doing, you know, why we do it.
One thing I'd add too is I think that we all have a shared commonality too when it comes to healthcare and medical devices. So, you know, no matter who you are, no matter how spooky you are, you know, what kind of surveillance you're doing or are afraid of, we're all human. We all get sick. We all get people in need of healthcare. And I think there is a truly shared commonality of, you know, when we check into a hospital, when we go to a clinic, no matter who you are, you want to make sure that that device has some integrity and that you can trust it.
So real quick, and we'll get into some of the disclosure too. We just want everyone to be aware that the stuff in our talk has been disclosed, and we'll talk about some of the more detailed disclosure processes as we go along. This is kind of a high-level timeline. So as you can see, we are working really hard to push our research quickly, and we are pushing really hard to get it out quickly to the community, and especially to healthcare organizations that and medical device manufacturers that can really make, you know, make a change here. So April 30th is when we went into this SMB finding disclosure that we're going to talk about here, and that was the first time we disclosed this information to DHS. We had a detailed briefing with them about a week later. And then we went into, after the SMB stuff, we decided to look at direct public-facing internet-exposed medical devices and infrastructure. And some of those were then disclosed in May. So again, it's really recent stuff. We've been working hard to get through the disclosure process so that we could talk to you about it. We've also been providing a lot of ongoing assistance to both federal organizations as well as, you know, healthcare organizations and manufacturers as we work through these things with them. So
if you're looking for 0 days, you're in the wrong room. So that's not how we do this. We try to be really responsible in all of our disclosure and all of our communication with this. We don't want to put people at risk. There's already enough risk in these devices that you'll see as we get further in the talk. And that leads into many of these vulnerabilities are old. In many respects, this is a new area for medical device manufacturers. And this type of exposure, because of the integration that's happening across healthcare with EHRs, going all the way to the bedside, there's going to be new attack surfaces that emerge. So Scott did some really great work on threat modeling with, and he'll demonstrate how just a very simple vulnerability was leveraged to impact potentially from an adversarial standpoint an entire organization, including their medical devices. So that should be a real wake-up call. I was a little scared about talking about that at first, more because it was such a low-level vulnerability, but then he...
Let's rock it.
Yeah, yeah. So then I didn't even say cyber yet. And then, so the other thing is the medical device exposure from the public internet. So as I mentioned, you know, more of these are coming online, there's greater integration. And there are medical devices on the public internet. We're trying to be responsible in disclosure while at the same time creating more pressure to an awareness of this too.
All right, taking a time out here.
Excuse me. Raise your hand
if
you're a brand new speaker at DEF CON.
Let's go.
All right, love for the new speaker.
Salute, salute.
All right.
Yeah, that's just awful.
So, these external findings pose a significant risk.
Our work is done. Let's go to the bar.
You guys are done.
All right, yeah, so what's the bad news here, right, in all of the findings? The external findings that we're going to expose, you know, we think it is a significant risk to patient safety, the medical devices, the supporting systems and technology that interface with these medical devices. The other bad news is most of these we found within 30 minutes to an hour. So, you know, I'm not up here to tell you I'm some, you know, elite hacker or anything like that. There's much smarter people in this audience, and we'll get into how you can help, you know, get into this area later. But it was very simple things that we did and threat modeling that we did here. But they are definitely significant risks to patient safety. They also provide support that the healthcare industry is very far behind other industries. Typical what we see in, you know, financial or retail sector, which they're getting breached every week as well. So there's not much difference, but it's not just your bank account. It is, you know, patient safety issues here that are affected. I think in our work, you know, one of the things that is coming to light, and, you know, the folks over at the agencies, DHS and ICS CERT, we'll probably start to tell you now is, you know, we always thought industrial control systems and that whole industry was quite a ways behind what we're seeing. But I think it's safe to say now, and with the research that we're showing, that the healthcare industry is probably 5 years behind what that is. So it's definitely a good 10 years. We've got a lot of catch up to do. We probably need to do it fairly quickly with some of the mobile health and digital health stuff that's coming on the horizon, which we'll touch on later. But that's definitely some of the bad news, so let Sean cover the good stuff. He can be the good guy.
Yeah, for once. You know, one thing I'd add, too, I mean, with the it's almost like a lost decade going on here, so with medical devices. And also, healthcare security folks are amongst the lowest paid in the industry, so that vertical itself, which is, I think, will actually change in the coming years. because there's going to be more breaches and there's going to be more specialized expertise which is needed with these devices. So there is good news. The external risk can be mitigated using your existing infrastructure in many cases. So you want to follow those hardening guidelines that are put out by like NIST and other organizations. And then CSI, right, too? Didn't we talk about that?
CIS,
rather.
Yeah, CSI, that's a TV show.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really not a drinker, so this is already getting to me. God damn goons.
CIS, they've reached out. I think we can probably talk about it a little bit later.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that later.
Their involvement, yep. But they're working on some benchmarking standards as well and tying those into ISO and things like that.
So just a show of hands here, who has heard of Shodan? Oh, that's good. That's encouraging. Shodan was one of the main tools that we used in this, and that's a tool that you can leverage in your own organization. And John Matherly, props out to him. This is his project. And so, using those types of tools, you can, discover what kind of exposure you have on your external network, and then you can start doing that mitigation.
All right, so just want to touch kind of quickly before we get into, some of the new stuff here on, previous research, more so, previous device exposure, across platforms, the types of things that we see, type of issues in these types of devices. So first, kind of lab and refrigeration systems. So that environment, and a lot of these, they're not unique to a vendor. So there's no value in saying, oh, it was this vendor, oh, it was that vendor. It's really across platforms. It's a systemic issue. It's not, one versus the other here. So we'll talk about them generically and kind of give you some architectural background into how these things function, where the flaws are in these devices, where an attacker could potentially cause patient safety issues. So refrigeration storage, these are anything from, storing just blood inside the laboratory all the way up to like full cryogenic, like freezer levels. The types of issues we see on these are they have unencrypted web services and they have hard-coded credentials. So the lab techs inside of a healthcare organization, they'll actually carry most times, sometimes they'll throw it in their desk, but usually they'll carry pagers that are set up to alert them if there's like an upper or lower limit on these devices that gets tripped. So if it's loses power and the temperature drops, they get alerted so that they can go respond and they can throw it into another refrigeration system. Well, through these web interfaces, which either have no authentication into them or they have very weak credentials into them, you can go into those types of systems and you can alter things. So first, you can turn off alerting or change the alerting to those pager systems. Secondly, you can change upper and lower limits on the temperature controls. You can even shut these units off. So those are the type of risks there, spoilage, things like that, that you get into with those devices. PACS imaging, that's not really a patient safety issue too much, but this is where you're seeing when you get to like the PHI stuff, not necessarily patient safety. But this is where I feel a lot of the exfiltration of patient documentation is coming out of healthcare organizations. All but one vendor that I've researched on the PACS imaging side, how they operate is through an application, through that PACS application, they call back-end storage for those imaging systems. Through the application, they actually prompt and they use authentication and they call it and they log if you've accessed that PHI. The back-end storage, unfortunately, happens to be in all but one case that I've looked at, completely unauthenticated access into the NAS device or the storage network for all of those patient records and images and PHI type information. So that's a big one. I think we'll loop this PACS thing back in later when we start talking about some of our exposure and how I believe a lot of our data is being leaked out very easily outside of healthcare organizations to sell people's medical identities. MRI and CT systems, you get into like nuke med systems as well. These are interesting. They pretty much function similar across the board when you get into CT, MRI systems. If you look at all the documentation, you'll find that there isn't a whole lot of difference on them. Nuke med machines, they actually have workstations that directly talk to it, but when you get into the radiology space, the MRI, the CT, that's when the rad tech is actually sitting in the room behind the behind the enclosure. And how those operate is obviously the physician orders what imaging they want and they program that order into the application and that actually gets sent down to like the CT systems. And so it kind of sits there in like a holding pattern. It almost functions like a queue inside those devices. But unfortunately, they use unencrypted web traffic as well. So you can man in the middle of that traffic. You can, you know, alter those types of things. They do have a failsafe, which is actually really good in most cases. Like the nuke meds are direct and they don't function like that, but that's not real radiation exposure. But the MRI and CTs, they kind of have like a Staples Easy button over at the side where a RadTech actually has to, you know, manually kind of hit, and then it goes out to the workstation and takes that cue and then processes that image. But because it's unencrypted and you can man in the middle of it, you can alter what's actually going on in there when they actually execute that. Defibrillators, this one's an interesting one. When you get into ICD technology, if any of you know who Kevin Fu is, he did a lot of great work. He actually documented it out. And most of these, they run on telemetry, so they run in like a 400K range. The problem with these is the pacemaker controller systems, if you access those, they don't require authentication. And once you associate it to the implantable defib, you can issue the command and it will reprogram, it'll set upper and lower sensing limits for the device on, you know, when to start shocking, you know, when to stop, so when to sense, like, you know, there's a cardiac event. And so those types of things you can also man in the middle. I think, you know, Kevin Fu, if you're really interested in the details of that, he did a great job. You know, look it up, you know, take a look at his research all the way back in 2008. There's obviously a clinical need for that too, and I will bring that up. And that's one of the challenges that you get into this space is, you know, you would hate for a patient to show up and, oh, I forgot the passcode in order to, you know, deliver a shock or reprogram this device. So that's the flip side of it. It's definitely, you know, a challenging area. Externals, I'm not going to talk too much about those. We have a very detailed case example with the specific manufacturer on external cardiac defibs that we're going to release today.
It's awesome.
And infusion pumps, these are ones that they have web interfaces on them. Oftentimes, you know, no authentication or weak credentials. They also have you know, excessive services. Medical device integration, this is an interesting one. So historically, you know, some of the very critical life-saving medical devices that were out there, so ventilators, anesthesia carts, things like that, they historically, and for a reason, weren't ever networked, right? So they just did serial interfaces, things like that. They weren't put on the network. Well, Affordable Care Act, things like that, and having to pump all this data to a centralized location in order to do big data analytics on healthcare populations, we've decided that we needed to integrate life support equipment. So we've gone with medical device integration vendors. A lot of healthcare organizations are doing this now and is bringing in these critical devices onto the network, reading those vital signs, and then ultimately transferring off. Again, completely unencrypted. No encryption. You can man in the middle of that. You can actually replay it. They do use unique identifiers, but you can correlate it all the way through from the unique identifier back to the patient. Whoops.
So these, you know, these are pretty much the top risks that we've identified so far, in, just across these systems. And again, you know, there's nothing terribly sexy about this, right? We've seen this for years. The hard-coded privileged accounts. It never goes away. It's going to be for here forever. Unencrypted web apps, and then, you know, all kinds of API calls, and then back-end services, like Scott mentioned earlier with the PACS systems going to the storage interfaces. And then, you know, many of these systems are built off of COTS equipment, so they're just using the medical device manufacturers or using your standard, maybe an embedded Windows or a VxWorks or a Windows 2003 or 2008 server.
Or then, XP or 2000.
XP. Yeah, it's out or embedded.
All over in healthcare.
Yeah, all over.
Legacy applications, and we'll kind of touch on that as we go through in our examples too.
Right. So you know, they're not OS experts, and typically they're not you know, removing the excessive services that are on these operating systems. And then there's the patching. So we'll talk about the patching issues more, but there's a real misconception out there about, hey, you can't patch medical devices, and that just is not true. The FBI, the FDA, there's no FBI here, right? They weren't invited. So the FDA has issued guidance for the past 10 years indicating that, yes, you can patch medical devices. But we'll get into that later about, you know, how you do that or should you do that or, you know, what are the risks associated with that.
So. Yeah, so that's kind of, you know, first round of research that kind of dabbled into for the last few years. And we were going to kind of stop there, but there was a lot of outreach to that and a lot of refutal of, you know, points that, yes, you found these issues in medical devices, but they're in internal networks, they're firewalled off from everything else. Well, you know, I called BS on that. It's definitely not how it is. And so I think we wanted to show that, you know, the public was really unaware, I think, and even a lot of IS staff inside of healthcare organizations were really unaware of this risk. And they truly believed that all of their devices were firewalled off, that you couldn't access them directly from the internet. This is a blurb from a private industry notice. Note that I'm not throwing out a private industry notice. This was off Google, and the media got a hold of it, so don't think I'm throwing out one of the FBI's pins to you guys. But this is a good quote that kind of shows the biggest vulnerability was the perception of IT healthcare professionals' beliefs that their current perimeter defense and compliance strategies were working when clearly the data states otherwise. So that's kind of, that's on an FBI pin. So they probably should start listening. It's just not some, you know, guy named Scott out there telling you.
And respect to the FBI for doing that,
I mean,
for stepping up, because if you really, you know, cut to the chase, this is almost kind of out of their purview until it gets into a criminal matter. I'm not a lawyer, but, this is getting into the FDA and, HHS, and so who has oversight of these issues? So it's great to see that the FBI is talking about this and raising awareness.
Yeah, and physicians as well. I think there needs to be more awareness on that end. Across healthcare organizations, a lot of systems get brought in from the physicians for clinical care. And security is an afterthought of that decision that's been made. And so we'll talk again a little further on, some involvement I've had now with, physicians and collaboration, which is great. And we need to, bring that awareness up. All the physicians I talk to, they care. They just don't know.
And I think really that's where we're going to see the rubber meet the road as far as physicians. You know, they're the ones who are handling and taking care of patients directly. They're tremendously respected, not only in the community, but within their organizations. And they have a lot of power. There were some MD students who were giving talks at this conference. We're developing relationships with them. We're seeing in academic medical centers an entire new generation of tech-savvy physicians getting trained. So we need to bring these people into the fold and explain the risk to them, and then get them on our side.
You can take this one, Sean. You found this awesome quote.
So everyone knows who Avi Rubin is, right? And he's a well-respected researcher, independent security evaluators. I think he's the president there. He's definitely one of the founders. And I just thought this was a wonderful quote, and it's, I've never seen an industry with more gaping holes. If our financial industry regarded security the way healthcare sector does, I would stuff my cash in a mattress under my bed.
Oh. Yeah, so that says a whole lot, I think.
And that was in 2012, right? 1225.
Yeah, that was a couple of years ago. All right, so let's get into first round of some of the exposure when we started to look at internet facing devices direct from internet public IP. So we started to research that, right? And we were doing some, custom, really elite searches for keywords like anesthesia that no one would ever think of. And we happened to, right away, within 30 minutes, we came across something that I clearly knew wasn't an anesthesia workstation itself. But we realized very quickly that it had SMB open. And I know, who cares about SMB, right? I didn't come to hear a DEF CON talk about SMB just being open. Well, I think the threat modeling that we're going to show you is really where that risk is, and the information that we could extract related to medical devices and supporting systems inside of a healthcare organization.
So this was Scott's finding, and we've been exchanging phone calls while we're doing these searches, and I'm sure those are archived somewhere, and perhaps someday we'll listen to them. It was amazing to see this because, he's like, dude, he sent me the search, and he's like, did that finish downloading yet off of Shodan? And I'm like, no, it still hasn't finished downloading. So this is the results page of what, the system is showing us. I'm like, no. So I had to jump on a VPS server that has a 10 gig 10 meg pipeline and pull it down. And then I got it quick and I did a page count and it was like 1,482 pages.
Just at one of the thousands of organizations.
But this was one box off of one organization with one port open. So it just goes to show that just one exposure here.
So here's a little bit more information on the initial healthcare organization discovery. This was the first one we found. I found it probably like 10:30 at night and was calling DHS at like midnight saying, hey, we got an issue here. Took the day off the next day and worked all day to find out, was it just an issue with one organization or was it really, a systemic issue across healthcare and, hundreds and thousands of healthcare organizations were wide open externally. Well, it turned out to be, even though we're using one example, the first example that we found, it's not just one organization's issue. It is across the world and in many instances, and we'll show you the statistics that we have on that. But to give you an idea of size, it was a very large U.S. healthcare system. They had over 12,000 employees, 3,000 physicians, and you'll see when we get into the actual medical devices and the systems that communicate with these medical devices, they did have large cardiovascular and neuroscience institutions attached to those. It exposed intelligence. When we dumped that 1,500-page document after we finally got it downloaded and extracted all the raw data, it was over 68,000 systems, provided a direct attack vector from externally, anywhere in the world, public IP, into those systems, full control if an attacker wanted it. It also exposed one of the things that we found that, again, isn't unique to this organization, it's across the thing, is we've seen indicators of third-party organizations that were connected and contracted for certain services. So, specialty services, things like that, that are contracted out by other organizations. We've seen those systems and, names used that were affiliated with those systems inside of there. So it wasn't just these organizations had an issue. They were also exposing third-party connections and security issues there as well.
And one thing, too, this also exposed a lot of your internal business operations, so HR systems, payroll, what we traditionally think of an attack vector and what attackers are going for. Interestingly, we were looking for healthcare and the medical exposure here, so there's EHRs and all that, but it was disconcerting to see all that business process systems exposure as well.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point, is it definitely wasn't, our focus was on, medical devices, healthcare infrastructure, things on patient safety, but this was, these 68,000 systems weren't just medical devices, it was their entire infrastructure. And so we can give you an example on all these medical devices and supporting systems that we found, but we also, if we were into talking about that, could have shown you just as many examples with financial systems, payroll systems, employee type confidential information as well. So again, did we find only one? No, we found hundreds. When you link them together, when you change the search term, so you can see right here, this is a screenshot inside of Shodan. But what we're doing is you can see the hits. So we're just doing searches, and then we're using keywords that would be associated with medical facilities. So HealthStar, so any type of like healthcare system that has that in their org name, clinic, hospital, and medical, and you can see the number of hits that had this exposure. Well, when you change that into, specialty things, so if you change that search term to like cardiology or radiology or urology or pediatrics or something like that, you're going to get all the organizations that have that inside of their org name. And then when you tie those into the third parties that were affected inside of those disclosures, you end up with, thousands of healthcare systems that are really affected.
So what's key to think about is, there's a lot of specialty small clinics. So when we've gone out and maybe got an MRI, you've got sent to a small specialty clinics, and then these are all tied in with healthcare systems too. And the kind of searches that we did here, which is the org name, if you're looking for specific clinics, you can do those types of searches too, and really get granular, even by geographic area. So Shodan is a very, very powerful tool. It's not the only tool to use this, but it was. Fit our needs and what we want to show at the time.
Yeah, and so here's some heat maps, and if you haven't checked out Shodan lately, we had access to the beta, thanks to John. And we actually have been able to work with him to do custom searches for certain ports that aren't publicly available, just to dig into a little bit more specific medical device exposure across the internet. But these are some new heat maps that he came out with, so definitely go and you know, check this out. It's kind of a neat feature. Not only will it show you the heat map overlay, but it'll also show you top affected domain names, organizations, you know, across the world. So this is just some heat maps for keywords of what we did and kind of the concentrations for high host down to low host count. You will see kind of a theme here that it is US centric. I don't know how to spell health in Chinese if they put that in their org name or things like that. So I don't know if that has to do with some of the disparate information or not. But the US definitely is a big red dot on all of this stuff. So this is one for the clinic. As you can see, US is still definitely top on the list for organizations that have this issue. Same with hospital. And here's the heat map for medical. It starts getting a little bit more interesting. The China and stuff starts getting big and red. One thing we did do is, we don't cover it in the talk, but I'll just talk about it, you know, quickly, is some of this customized stuff that we're doing with Shodan, and that was just released as well, is X11. So if you want to go and search like port 6000 now on X11, we did that with John and he just released that publicly. So there's a lot of unauthenticated X11 devices. We weren't able to correlate it directly back to medical devices, so we're not talking about it, but he has released it. There's like 60,000 systems out there, 30,000 of which are completely unauthenticated across the internet. So who cares about SMB? Again, you know, why did we skip Dan Kaminsky's talk to come watch a bunch of posers talk about SMB, right? But that's not it. It's really the threat model here. And why does this matter? You know, who cares? Well, this system and others like it also happen to be Windows XP and vulnerable to MSO 8067. And for those of you that weren't in the security industry back then, that is, you know, the exploit or the vulnerability that can configure utilized. So this is old. This is from 2008. Still have external facing systems running SMB. Also, you can pop that box direct. So this is kind of a host profile, the OS, just a screen cap. Obviously, the information's hidden on this organization.
And I pushed back against Scott on this, too, when he first brought it to me. I was like, this really isn't that interesting. I mean, once we started looking more into the full exposure of this organization, and he painted the picture for me, then it became much clearer. And so that's what's coming here.
So why does it matter? And what I'm going to show you here in the next slide, why does it matter? Well, the SMB, as we know, it by design is going to leak host names. Well, who really cares about host names necessarily? But what we also realized with these healthcare organizations is that not only was SMB open, but read access, anonymous read access to their Active Directory infrastructure was also pulling through directly to the internet and exposing all this detailed information that allowed us to identify, you know, specific medical devices, not just medical devices themselves, but the supporting technology systems and applications. And I want to clarify on that. Everyone talks medical devices, and a lot of people may think that it's just, you know, implantables or just the actual device itself, you know, the CT scan or the MRI system, the actual infusion pump. But understand, it's a large ecosystem here. No longer is it just standalone systems. So those workstations that they're using, they interact and they have the application that issues instructions to the medical device, to the patient. So that's why, you know, all these workstations and things like that are so important, because they do have direct access to communicate with the medical devices through the application. So it leaked out host names, and it oftentimes leaked out very specific information that attacker could use. So we'll show you some examples in here of, you know, the floor, the office, physician names are in here. And also, AD policy was applied. So, like the ORs, by design, most healthcare organizations set timeouts in ORs.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. And, you know, the reason they do that is because they're all scrubbed up, right? I mean, that's the, you know, the reason they don't want to be messing around with big clunky gloves having to unlock it. But you'll see some examples here that shows us that these specific systems also have timeout exemptions in place. So let's get into, you know, what are the systems you found? Show some examples here. Why does this matter? Let's paint the picture of why, you know, it's not just SMB, but it's really a threat model here. So over on the left, you can see those are the systems with a lockout exemption. So that is something where we know that the screensaver timeout isn't going to kick in. So that matters, right? So especially in like a physical attack scenario that we get into later, that matters because I'll know what system has a timeout exemption. Over on the right, here's this customer happened to use Epic. Please know, again, this isn't a manufacturer issue. This is just the organization, and all these organizations had a misconfiguration. So this isn't anything that Epic or a manufacturer can fix themselves, but this is just an example. You can see all their servers here. These are used for everything from the SQL Server backend all the way into web servers. I believe down there towards the bottom, my chart is if anyone here goes as a patient to a healthcare organization and they use Epic, my chart is your portal into all of your medical record data. So that's this organization's server. We now know we can hit it directly from the net. All right, let's talk about a little bit more stuff. So PACS imaging, we talked about those previously. We've seen through our research that they don't require on the back end authentication, or the one manufacturer I have ran across that does. The little kids over in Roots could probably crack in about 3 minutes. So it's not very difficult. So here's radiology systems. Here's the CT system, PACS, you know, CT3 right there. So that's some of the radiology stuff. Down in the bottom, telemetry. There's a couple use cases for telemetry systems. We can't tell exactly just off this what exactly that device is for. We can only profile in this case. So telemetry can be used for different things. It can be used for infant abduction systems or wandering adult patients, those types of things. They use the little armband to alert, you know, if the mother or the child are too far apart or if one gets, you know, taken off the unit. Telemetry is also obviously used, and we'll show you some examples of this for, you know, pacemakers, pacemaker controller type systems. Speaking of pacemakers, here's some pacemakers. We also had specific examples that were very labeled as pacemaker controller. So we know that those were the pacemaker controller systems inside of an organization. We know that those pacemaker controller systems don't require any type of authentication to communicate once they've associated to a implantable. You can also see here, we've scrubbed it, but there's an example in here of you can see doctor, whatever that is, and you can see those types of examples, specifically where they're at. Second one there, there's pediatrics, nuclear medicine. Down on the bottom, this is when you get into anesthesia, right? Anesthesia OR. We know that this is an anesthesia workstation. The OR environment is very controlled. So thinking that you would have, you know, anesthesia OR labeled separate from the anesthesia workstation that's directly attached to the anesthesia cart, there's just no way. This is definitely an anesthesia workstation that's on the anesthesia cart inside of the OR. You can hit it directly from the internet. So we found a few of these devices, right? You're giving us some examples. You're showing us some screenshots, type of the devices that you found. Well, we didn't. We took that big log for this specific organization of the thousands that we found. We dumped out the raw data, and we started to extract that data, and we identified thousands of, you know, medical devices and those supporting systems and those applications. So we used our favorite data extraction tool called Excel because we're really sophisticated.
He did. I haven't got my Excel certification yet.
Yeah. So this is an overview. So we took all that raw data, we dumped it to Excel, and then basically what we did is we just did a search and a find for keywords on these types of devices. So we did a search for anesthesia. There was 21 systems that were affiliated with anesthesia inside this organization. Cardiology, 488. Like I said before, they had a very large cardiology institution and a nuclear medicine, NucMed neurology institution as well. Infusion systems, found 133 systems. MRIs, 97. The PAC systems, 323. So I think right here, again, it goes to point that, I don't know, maybe healthcare security is lax enough and poor enough right now that the attackers, you know, aren't using the simple attack method to get in and get information on the devices. Maybe they're just, you know, plastering everybody and they're able to go completely undetected. But if not, they could do a little bit of research and they can find out, hey, just this one healthcare organization has 323, you know, devices associated to PACS and imaging in some way or another. NucMed system, 67. And ultimately, on the cardiology side, 31 systems associated to pacemakers. So potential attacks in this scenario, threat modeling for this SMB exposure that leaks all of this information, right? We've got a few of those. The lamest one, but still a viable option, is, you know, a physical attack. We now know a lot of information. We know what types of systems they are as an attacker. We know what types of medical devices they're associated to. We know the healthcare organization and the location. We know the floor and the office number in lots of cases, like I showed you. And we know if that system has a lockout exemption. So we can now very strategically, right, Sean, we can walk in and kind of pinpoint, we want to go to this floor, this office number, we know it's a cardiology doc that's seeing this patient. We want to go walk in, we know it's got a timeout exemption, we can probably sit down, never have to put in a password and get access to that system.
And when it comes to healthcare organizations, you know, it's not like walking into a financial institution where they're like a beady-eyed banker is looking at you like he's gonna, you know, you're gonna take his money. Healthcare organizations, you walk in there and there's people at the desk, hi, how can I help you, right? So they're very susceptible to a number of physical types of attacks. Plus you throw a lab coat on, a stethoscope around your neck, you print up a badge, you know, which you can just easily do just from, you know, trolling the halls and looking and seeing what they look like. You know, it really opens up a scary avenue of attack because nobody really thinks about this.
So what's the next one that we can kind of look at for an attack in this scenario in these organizations? Obviously a phishing attack. We're all very familiar with that, right? Again, we know what systems they are we want to target. We know the healthcare organization. We know employee names, so we can start extracting email addresses for those employees. You know, that's very simple to do. And we know the host name, and that's the key thing. We know the host name. We know what type of device it is. So we can write customized payload now that we can deliver through a phishing attack that once it's executed and once we have control on that internal system or even from that external facing system that had MS-08067, we can directly pivot to only hit the devices that we want to hit. So an attacker can be very strategic with this type of information, right? They don't have to, you know, get a foothold and then scan the entire network and figure this out and be really noisy. They don't have to do that. They can simply, you know, send a phishing attack and then target directly towards these medical devices. Pivot attack. This is obviously external for those systems that had vulnerabilities. MS-08067 is just, you know, one of them. A lot of them are running vulnerable versions, IIS-6 that are sitting out there, plus a lot of extra, you know, excessive services that are vulnerable as well. We also know in this pivot attack that it's touching the back-end network because it's leaking all of the data for every one of their things. It's also giving us read access into Active Directory. So we know there's a hole and that there's a hop and it's not firewalled off. So again, we can create a custom payload directly and pivot internally. Targeted attack, this one is, you know, where you start to make the case for a targeted attack against a targeted patient, those types of scenarios, right? We can use the information we got over SMB, so we know the systems that are associated. We also now know every single name of every one of their medical record servers. So all we have to do is strategically target those specific systems once we have a foothold in the network. So then an attacker can take that, attack the medical record, get a weak password, get a vulnerability in some legacy application, and we can start correlating where the patients are going to be when and correlate that with the SMB data of where these devices are located and what type of devices they are. And then, you know, launch an attack. So what's the good news out of this? I just want to touch on this example healthcare organization. This was very positive. This is new space. DHS and ICS CERT did coordinate the disclosure and with this healthcare organization, among others, that we used in our example, they did schedule a follow-up call. And so I did talk with the healthcare organization and DHS. They actually, it was a very positive exchange. So typically, we're dealing, as security researchers, we're oftentimes dealing with manufacturers, right? And we're starting to get over those bounds as well, but initially, and the first time of everything, you know, there's a lot of legal landmines and pitfalls that you got to get through. So this was a big win for us. This is something that, you know, I'm proud of. This was the first time, you know, DHS says they've actually worked with a security researcher and an actual healthcare organization to expose these risks and work through it. They did step up. They showed good faith. I'm not going to speak to what it contained, but they did actually share their full incident response with me, and I went through that with that organization. So it was a very positive win overall in that interaction. So I want to call that out. So I think Sean's going to talk on public internet-facing systems, and is there any devices directly on the net?
I should have stayed over there. The light's much better.
So that was the first part, kind of our talk here of the SMB exposure. And just bear in mind, you know, we focused on one organization, but we could have done this with a number of organizations. But just for the brevity and the exposure, we just did that one. So medical devices on public internet. I mean, you really wouldn't think this is the case. You know, so a public IP address, and then you've got this medical device there, but it is. And some of these are by design and on purpose. And what really makes this tricky is that some are using cellular modems. So, and the reason is they may be remote clinics, or they want to separate that in some ways from the other infrastructure. But what that does for ethical researchers who want to track down these devices and then associate that with a healthcare organization, it makes it very difficult for us to do that. So that's really where we need to reach out, to the carriers and the FDA and HHS and even law enforcement, because they have the capability to correlate those cellular modem addresses and IPs to these medical devices. So this is just four examples that we focused on of what we found out there. And I mean, these are publicly accessible on public IP defibrillators, and those Scott's going to really give you an excellent case study about that later on. They're deployed in ambulances, and then these fetal infant monitoring systems, which if you follow any of my Shodan talks over the past few years, I've been yammering about, and I'll get into more of those. EEG systems, so those are hooked up to folks at home, and then they're tied into a cellular modem. And then, of course, PACS and imaging systems. Now, the really interesting thing about PACS systems is that when they take these MRI images of you, they're gigantic files. So there's a storage backend. We talked about that. But then transferring them is an issue, too. And then what's going on is there's consolidation in the industry of analysts who are specialized in doing this type of analysis. So, you know, there may be somebody working across the country from home and doing, all day long. She's just looking at these images and then doing the analysis, writing up a report, and then sending that back to the healthcare organization. So it makes it much easier, right, to just stick this out on public IP. They can access it directly over a web interface. You don't have to allocate a VPN session to them. They're not choking up your bandwidth and that kind of thing. More traditional hardware infrastructure that we found exposed was, just your old unauthenticated and misconfigured Cisco devices and edge routers, and these have been known for years. They're really easy to find. And then also device manufacturer infrastructure, and then these third-party contracted organizations. And what I mean by that, and Scott's going to talk a little bit about this too, if you want. But what I mean about that is, hospitals are tremendously complex organizations. So, just because there's a device on a hospital or a healthcare network doesn't necessarily mean they even own it. They may not even know about it. And when you get into academic medical research centers, you may have a professor who's also a physician. So, and then they have somebody, they're doing a research project on, and then they got this device, and then they allocate it to a public IP. So, the IT folks may not know about it. The security folks typically will not know about it at all. And so these things just show up on the network. Did you have something to say on this?
Yeah, I think in the healthcare systems, too, understand the one that we found, the one we just closed, the DHS, this wasn't small family clinic. This was a very large healthcare organization. It was not the same organization as their other example, but it was very large. They had over 13,000 employees, just to give you some idea of, size of the organization. So it wasn't a small thing, completely unauth edge router just sitting out on the net. All their infrastructure was exposed. A lot of the manufacturer side, what we've seen and what is accessible, a lot of those that we found aren't necessarily, fault of the manufacturer. It's really implementation issues at the location. But some of those come back to poor documentation or guidelines from the manufacturer. We see some documentation out there that straight up for support reasons in their documentation tells you to open every single port on the firewall for remote connectivity from these vendors, which obviously is a little reckless. Not sure how they're QAing those documents, but it's obviously not needed, and some folks are doing it.
So we've got a few case studies that we're going to walk through, and this was the first reported medical device, meaning reported to ICS CERT, and I found this in late 2012, and it was a Roche glucose meter, and so this is a portable glucose meter to take blood sugar measurements, and it has this base station on there, and the base station just had Telnet running. But there was authentication required for it, but I mean, Telnet, it's clear text protocol. Now, the vendor response was awesome. Hat tip to the Roche guys. They were all over this, good communication, and then a really good DHS and ICS response on this, too. This really gets more troubling, and you know, I alluded to the PAC systems before and the reason why these are exposed online, and there are hundreds, and even if you know, you start doing a look at different versions, really thousands of them, and this is just the Kodak ones. And so, you know, Scott talked about the ecosystem before, right? So it's easy to just think, oh, this standalone medical device, and you know, what are the risks associated with it? But there's a whole client infrastructure that comes along with this, and how do your clients communicate with it? And if you see here, it's required to use Internet Explorer 6.0 on this system.
Yeah, that's not that uncommon either, by the way.
So it's not that uncommon, but then you think about these systems and, okay, are they dedicating that box, you know, and that client browser just for that system? Or is whomever is using this going to jump online and, you know, start looking at different sites and get hit with a drive-by, you know, browser attack or, you know, something bad through their Yahoo email? So, again, it's just perspective. But again, and then these are, you know, on public IP. This fetal monitor, I've been yakking about these for a couple years now. And so I first reported these in about December 2012. And then there's also been some media coverage. So these have been you know, mentioned specifically in mainstream media and you know, haven't really had people reach out to me about these, which I was surprised because, I mean, if there's one thing that we can think about is, you know, fetal monitors, meaning, my perspective is that, you know, you should have the opportunity to be born before you get hacked, right? That's not too much to ask for, okay? And these are the most you know, vulnerable people in our population. I mean, you got a mom in bed expecting a baby. You know, can't we do better than what we're doing here with this? So, you know, when Scott and I decided to collude and do this talk, you know, I really amped it up. And so I, you know, I disclosed it again to DHS and then, you know, went to the manufacturer, whom I'm not going to mention, I'm not going to mention the device specifics on this, but I also went to the FDA, the Office of Civil Rights, and the Joint Commission, because I've gotten to the point that, you know, if you put these out there, you put people at risk, you deserve a fine. And that's the business side, right? That's when people start paying attention. Gotta hit them in the pocket. So here's a showdown map of the fetal monitors on public IP, and it really doesn't disclose.
That's a really crappy picture.
It's a horrible picture, but you know, if you look in the United States, right, you'll just see one big dot, and one big dot is in the United States is there in the center. You'll see a couple down in Florida and down in Puerto Rico, but you know, the ones in the U.S., you see a big dot there, and that's because of the cellular modem issue, right? So, you know, it doesn't give you a Shodan will not give you a geographic location on that cellular modem. So we got a fetal monitor hooked up to a cellular modem, don't know the organization it's affiliated with, very, very difficult to track that down. Anyone, and that gets into a phone call I had with the FDA, you know, the first question from their security guy was like, oh, well, how do I find these? I'm like, dude, call the FBI.
You know? Yeah, it ends up being, just so you guys, if you end up doing any research and aren't aware of that, it ends up in a field like 10 miles northeast of Portland, Kansas. And so that field is actually a geographical center of the United States. And so anything that it's not able to track geolocation back to, that's why you'll see a huge influx outside of Portland, Kansas in a field. It's not a bunch of people out there with fetal monitors and devices sitting.
And I'll tell you,
it's not a hacker camp in the middle of the field.
And Kansas is so boring, you almost want to drive around it. So here's some system details on this. And so, you know, there's two different models out there that are running. And the first is a Windows 2003 server, and it's running IIS 6.0, right, 16 systems. So doing my research on available public documentation that, you know, it's, and that's another thing, you know, documentation control for this from the vendor side, they get third-party integrators, these guys pop up an FTP server, and then the vendor documentation gets leaked out. So then a guy like me can come along and then find it. Usually it's very tightly controlled. So I knew right away after reading documentation that, you know, these 16 systems that are out there are behind on their vendor updates. And props to the vendor, because on this particular system, they're doing a good job. They're actually vetting the patches, they're upgrading systems and going at the CDs. But then you get in a situation where they, you know, these are constantly in use, and you have to have an IT department, you know, upgrading them, or you have to contract that out. You get smaller healthcare clinics, money's an issue. Think about how it is on like a Native American reservation, right? You know, these things are expensive to run. The second one was the 2008 server, and that's IIS 7.0. And by the way, not all these systems are currently exposed online, so there's a historical context here, but over the past couple of years, I've just seen more and more of them pop up online. So some have been retired, some have been taken down. So the remote access is done through remote desktop web access, which is done through the browser, or there's the terminal services clients. And when I did raise a question and did get in touch with you know, FDA and vendor, I couched this because I knew I could get them attention. I couched this as like a HIPAA compliant issue, not just the public IP exposure, but the way the communication happened with the RDP clients. And there is technically ways, I'm not a HIPAA expert, but ways to make this HIPAA compliant and using the FIPS, correct FIPS approved crypto levels, certificate sharing and such. But that really wasn't documented from what I saw in the vendor documentation, though it could have been. And yeah, so there were some questions about that. And then again, I'll go props to the vendor because they said that these should be deployed on a secured connection. So meaning, you know, with a VPN, and I believe that they will be updating their documentation.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons we're not naming the vendor. We don't feel, you know, that this one's necessarily a manufacturer issue. If it was a manufacturer issue and they were, you know, actually recommending that we expose them, we probably would drop their name, as I will drop a vendor name later in this discussion.
Yeah, stay tuned. It's going to get a little hairy. That's all him. the FDA model reports, if you're not familiar with FDA, there's a user event database that they have. And so what I did is, you know, I correlated, I didn't do the correlation. I went into the FDA mod and I was looking for anything that could be tied to this particular monitoring system, what kind of problems they've had from the field that people have reported. So some of those I saw that these alarm capabilities have been muted or disabled. And that led me to wonder, okay, is this possible that, you know, these particular exposed devices, is there correlation with the FDA MOD database and those reports that, you know, perhaps there's an attack going on here that we don't know about? It's hard to tell from MOD, and MOD reports are really, they're sanitized, and the search interfaces are horrible. So where we are today is this is disclosed to DHS. There's many on public IP. Many are running IIS 6.0. And by the way, I'm able to tell all this from Shodan. So I am not going to these individual systems. I'm not connecting to them. I'm not looking at the versions. I'm not scanning them. I can derive all this information from Shodan, including the last scan date. So there is a historical record in Shodan. The vendor did reach out to me. We had a conference call. They're interested in what they characterize the customer misuse case, and that is completely accurate. And really, it's the beginning of security researcher communication. You know, one of their security people is like, "Yeah, I've known about you for a few years. You have the MedSec group. You know, we get a little apprehensive talking to you." And the reason is because, you know, they don't have me locked in, right? I'm not under an NDA. I'm not an employee. I'm just a guy out here who's you know, interested in this and wants to improve public safety. So, you know, it's a wild card, right? How do you handle somebody like that? And I can appreciate that. So I believe that they might have sent a folk or two here, and I hope we can grab a beer later and, you know, continue to build this relationship, because this is where it's going to come. Lessons learned. You know, we need a better reporting method on this. We need to have, you know, some teeth in something and a way to track these at a formal government level. There needs to be coordination happening across these different agencies. I'd love to see, like, a task force that evolved out of this where, okay, we found a device We're able to get the public IP correlated to a healthcare provider, send the people in, ask them to disable it. You know, if there's a PHI leak or something along those lines, consider a fine. You know, again, I'd hate to see a small, poor hospital, you know, out in the middle of nowhere get hammered with a HIPAA fine. But again, it makes the news, and hopefully that drives change. So
let's talk about some adversary misconceptions and some emails I've gotten on our research, public comments, people that I've had to deal with. One of the things that I get is, well, who the heck would do this? They only care about financial gain, right? They don't care about anything else. All they care about is going into those PAC systems, exfiltrating patient data and selling it. And yeah, that's true. Russians, they're going to sell it, right? That's what they do. But the other thing, the other misconception, and honestly, there was this guy that posted on a recent article, and he actually said, ignorant people, he said that, hey, these people live in caves and you're giving them all the information to get into the devices. And they're not smart enough to figure this out on their own because they live in caves. And I had email communications with this guy like 30 times, and he just wouldn't give it up. He was so convinced that they aren't technically adept enough to carry this out. And as we showed you, this isn't a technical attack here. This is basic, you know, security 101 concepts that one thing gets missed, and there's kind of this cascading effect for patient safety, right? And it opens up this huge threat model that we have to be aware of. So who do we need to worry about? I think, terrorists and extremists, technically adept, when you get into, you know, ISIS, when you get into nation state, that's kind of who we need to worry about, and that's what I thought about. And then Sean, and he can talk to this, he brought up this interesting article that I had never thought of. Oh man, a patient, maybe themselves, could be an adversary in a way. So I'll let you talk
article. Just quickly run through this. So, you know, here's the situation. You know, you've got a patient in a hospital with a gunshot wound. Guy's lying in bed, he's got his laptop there, and he's got a morphine.
This is awesome, by the way.
Yeah, and he's getting a morphine drip, you know, right through an infusion pump. So, obviously, he's like, I'm in pain, I want more juice. How do I do this? The guy went online.
We didn't make this up, there's the link.
Guy went online, found the manual for this infusion pump, and then was able to break into it and then reprogram it. And he ended up going into an overdose, and then it happened to a couple guys in this healthcare organization in Austria. It's just something when you think about it. It's like, oh, we always think about, you know, who's at risk and who's the adversary here. Well, you know, the guy who's being treated for this could very well be the adversary from a healthcare standpoint. So one of the things that really, you know, gets scary, and this is easy to kind of dismiss as a, just theoretical, or you're watching too much TV or reading too many books, but the, think about these Boston Marathon bombing and the Sinarna brothers, right? And think about if they had set off, you know, 10 bombs and then, timed another 10 to go off, right, when all the emergency personnel came in. This is what happens in countries like Israel when we see first a bomb goes off, all the emergency personnel rush in there, then the second one goes off. And what I think we need to start worrying about in the future is going to be the electronic attacks against the critical infrastructure like hospitals and then power, but, you know, more so hospitals because they're such soft targets. So think about the impact of, you know, a bomb goes off, all the EMT guys get hit with a second bomb, then they're bringing everybody to the hospital, and then everything shuts down in the hospital. And even Boston Children's recently got hit on our public website because of the Pelletier case, which Anonymous picked up on. So we're seeing this already starting to manifest itself. And it's all about capability, right? The capability is there to do this, and
One thing to add to it, I think this is where, you know, historically DHS, ICS, CERT, and the FDA were the one issuing advisories. It wasn't until April that the FBI all of a sudden got involved, and they issued two privacy industry notices last April. They kind of came out of left field. Like, why the hell is the FBI all of a sudden issuing, you know, private industry notices about risks to medical device exposure? This is one of their fears, right, is the combined attack, and that's the type of thing that they're looking at. That's why they're looking into this space a little bit more closely, and why they've, you know, we've started to work with them and build that relationship up is really these types of scenarios.
All right, so the military term for this is force multiplier.
Yep. So Ed, on the bottom here, Cyber City, they're already doing this, right? You know, the government obviously is looking at it. They think it's a risk. We should probably take a look at it. I mean, Ed's been doing this for a few years now, but Cyber City is basically, they have all that critical infrastructure, this detailed out as critical infrastructure. So they have the healthcare, they have the financial, they have the ICS stuff, they have the transportation. It's just a big, you know, training lab for if a combined attack took place, how would we be able to react for it? So it is taking place already.
So really, you know, one of the questions that comes into this is a whole new area of medical devices. You know, how do you even know that if a medical device was hacked? You know, one of the first things that you'll read about and when you start looking in the space in the articles is to say, there's no documented evidence of a medical device attack happening. But how would you know? I mean, we don't have the forensics capability really matured yet at all in this, except for, you know, there is some open source stuff, right, if it's built on COTS equipment, but it's mostly closed source code. You know, vendors aren't sharing this code. And then with these devices, you need specialized diagnostic equipment. You're running proprietary protocols and code. So it's very, very difficult, and you need specialized people and the vendor to help you with any type of cyber forensics exercise. Then you get into the device experts. So, you know, looking on LinkedIn, I only found two people who really claimed any expertise.
Definitely an official source, way better than Wikipedia.
Yeah. But only two people that I found, and the first was, you know, a woman from the FDA, total track record, and then the second
not
was
an expert.
A retired FBI agent who was one of the founding, you know, members of their cyber squads. So, you know, those are like two people. But so those of you who are thinking about, you know, forensics in the future, or maybe if you're in healthcare, this is something to consider as far as a career path.
And one thing here on this last bullet point that's important to understand, too, when we talk about, you know, a low assurance that an attack, either intentional or unintentional, hasn't taken place against these devices with adverse events. The FDA, the adjudication process of a medical device-related malfunction that gets reported, a healthcare organization has a responsibility and a requirement to report a medical device-related malfunction. And so they report that to the FDA. Well, if you go to the FDA's website, it'll directly tell you, and their quotes are, several hundred thousand of medical device-related malfunctions. So they adjudicate this. If something happens and there's an adverse event for a patient, they do a clinical adjudication to say, oh, the patient, you know, died from pneumonia on a ventilator, or there's, you know, died of old age, or that type of thing. If not, they don't really do, you know, security. They don't look at forensics because there's not a whole lot of information there to look at. And so they throw it in this generic button or bucket of several hundred thousand medical device related adverse, you know, deaths and serious injuries every year. We don't know what they are. And then the mod reports suck and they are very specific and stripped out. So we don't really have the information. We don't have the forensic details. So, you know, how could we really prove this at this point? So this gets into HIPAA. I'm going to flip through this really quick. You're switching with me.
HIPAA. I'm not going to argue that it's ineffective, but why are we in this space? Doesn't it protect us? I get this too. I get all these emails all day long of why isn't HIPAA doing something, right? HIPAA focuses on patient privacy. It's not focused on, you know, necessarily patient safety. Human life is much more irreplaceable than PHI. So I would encourage you guys to, you know, start looking at that. If you work for healthcare organizations, definitely start looking into that. It doesn't focus on medical devices, and it definitely doesn't focus on adversary resilience testing at all. Don't the federal agencies protect you? That's another one. Shouldn't the FDA be doing this, right? Well, it's your responsibility as a manufacturer, as a healthcare organization. They've told manufacturers since last year when Billy Rios, Terry McCorkle came out with the infamous 300 list. And these are some of the alerts, if you want to look them up later, that came out specifically telling healthcare organizations and medical device manufacturers that they, at this point, aren't going to get involved and that it's their responsibility to take care of it. So how did healthcare kind of get to the state that it's at? 10 years behind. It's back to HIPAA, in my opinion. If you work in the industry, information security programs in healthcare were primarily funded and developed to comply with HIPAA. So we all know, you know, security is not compliance or information assurance, but that's how these programs have been built. They've been built for checkbox security, and
we buy this appliance and we check this box and, oh, hey, we're secure because HIPAA says we're secure. Where are the issues in the manufacturers? Well, we've never had, you know, this is kind of a similar space even in the auto industry, right? Historically, especially when you look at, you know, life cycles of these devices, that for implantables, even on an expedited approval from the FDA, from prototype to, you know, market release, can be 12 to 13 years. So we've never had to design for adversarial threats. We never really thought about it. We took these medical devices that existed and we just decided, oh, it'd be great if we could get data on this and manage them remotely so we don't have to waste time and be more efficient. But now we kind of have the unintended consequences that we're seeing here in our research, you know, across healthcare organizations. And the other thing, you know, they haven't fully embraced, this is getting better. Most of the large healthcare you know, manufacturers are starting to reach out. We're starting to build those relationships. There's a lot of one-offs, and we'll get to one of these examples of a company that just will not talk to us coming up here that we're going to show a use case on. But so if you reach out to us and actually talk to us, we probably won't be as mean to you. But no, you know, we're there. We're really there. I think we have a combined effort, and they're starting to embrace it. We're doing a really good job. We're making a lot of progress there. So I'm definitely hopeful, you know, that that will continue. It's, you know, it's not, you know, when you talk to the manufacturers that, you know, they don't care. You know, to their benefit, I mean, they are very large. A lot of this does take time. It is a culture change. And so, you know, they're getting there. They're building out these teams. They're hiring the right people and giving them, you know, internally the authority. But this is just some of the larger manufacturers, not these one-offs, not to mention when we get into digital health and mobile health things. So, does anyone work for healthcare organizations? Wants to admit it? Okay. All right. So, how many of you have been told by a manufacturer that you can't patch your systems, like your medical devices, right? Exactly, it's a crutch. And here's the link. I mean, like Sean said, they've been telling you the FDA, there is, you know, a cybersecurity clause for patching. There's a very small percentage that would actually have to go back through 510K. The only case is if it's a clinical care issue, patient safety issue on some types of implantables. Who else has been told they can't change hard-coded credentials that they may have located for the manufacturer, right? All right, so that gets into my next bullet point. I want to, you know, spend a little time kind of clarifying this. This is a big point, and both sides need to understand this. So if you're in healthcare, you know, please listen to this. On the healthcare side, whose biomedical teams are integrated with IS? Oh my God, there's not a single hand that I can see, but I'm a little blinded.
We have two over there.
Awesome. That is great. So how this works and where this disconnect is you as someone in security, you find a bug or a flaw in a device that you want to report. You go to your biomed technician, your biomed tech takes your report, interprets it in his little biomed language, and who does he contact from the manufacturer? He contacts a support technician at the manufacturer. Well, the support technician isn't their security people, doesn't have any idea. So they get your report that says, we have a hard-coded credential. How it works on the manufacturer side is that field support tech goes to their supervisor and says, hey, we have a report from a customer that we need to change this. And the supervisor's like, how the hell are we going to get into the customer's systems if we change the password, right? So it stops right there. And he's not thinking security, right? He's not their security person. But he tells that field support tech to tell the biomed person that they can't change it. And so it comes back to healthcare organization in a way as an official response from that healthcare organization that they're not going to fix it and we don't push it anymore. So there's a big disconnect there on both sides. There's a disconnect between biomed and IS on the healthcare side, and there's a disconnect between how do we inbound handle, you know, vulnerabilities at the manufacturer to make sure that the security folks at those organizations that have implemented those programs can effectively be aware of them first off and then drive, you know, the process behind that to make sure they're resolved. And also, I would highly encourage you to, you know those information security people. So if you don't know, especially at your big vendors, the ones you spend lots of money and have lots of equipment with, reach out and find out who those folks are and build up those relationships because it's very important.
So when it comes to patching, you know, the question is yes, you can patch, but should you? So there's a good 8-10 years of FDA guidance saying that you can patch these systems, but this is something that you need to really work with on your vendors with and do coordination, because you've got a very complex ecosystem going on here. And then what if something that you do in-house breaks the device? So, you know, the vendor coordination has to happen with this issue, and there's going to be some smaller vendors who are not going to be, you know, ready to work with you on this as well as a larger vendor would be. So the other thing is, you know, many health care organizations are reluctant to patch just because of the complexity and the changes that can happen in these systems. And if you go back in the FDA mod reports, there's many, many examples of patches that have gone wrong, or health care organizations that are comfortable patching, say, the computer PC that connects to the medical device that's running, both are running Windows. They'll patch one, the one that you use to run the device, but they don't want to patch the device itself that actually connects to the patient, which is completely understandable. The antivirus question is another one. And, you know, we can get off on a side tangent here with antivirus, but the main points that I wanted to bring here were that there's a lot of reports of negative impact of antivirus. And that's like everything from, oh, your 90-day license expired, and, you know, this is an OR situation, and then this pop-up is coming and popping up saying your license is expired. Everything to bad McAfee DATs. And not to pick on McAfee at all, but if you recall back in April in 2010, this bad DAT went out, and it identified a core Windows file as malicious, and then all these machines, all these XP machines, just started going into a continuous reboot. So if you were working in a healthcare organization at that time, you were running around manually hitting every single box and fixing them. And just as a small example, is a third of the hospitals in Rhode Island were impacted by this. So many, many people were, who, especially some of these, you know, if you've been doing this a while. There's also direct events of AV deleting fetal monitoring logs.
When they actually log.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, this is a complex issue. And then, you know, you'll have some clients or, you know, customers have pushed back on vendors saying we have to run antivirus on this. So the vendors are in a bad position, and they may recommend one or they may not recommend one. And then the other thing they'll do, often you'll see this in the documentation, is say disable this particular feature of the antivirus. So they'll say disable on-demand scanning. Which, okay, now we have this antivirus on there, we've checked our happy checkbox, but then we've basically hobbled a key protection mechanism and function of this antivirus itself. So, you know, again, it comes back to a risk basis here. What are we really trying to accomplish here? Are we just trying to, you know, check a checkbox, or are we trying to reduce risk? Because there could be cases where, you know, many cases, why would you even want to have antivirus on it? But unless you're getting it directly from the vendor, you know, you probably don't want to run it.
Some solutions and recommendations. I'll just touch these quick, right? I mean, external attack surface reduction and hardening, that's important. We've obviously shown you that this is not being done appropriately, right? Mitigate, first you need to recognize, and you actually need to use a tool like Shodan in your organization and start recognizing those and work to mitigate them. You know, you don't need to use Shodan. You can use the API for automation. You can, you know, use continual monitoring, mass scan, ZMAP, those types of tools you can also use. You don't need to use just Shodan. And, you know, make your external perimeter Metasploit proof. We don't see this in a lot of healthcare organizations. We don't see these skill sets being employed because, again, going back to HIPAA, we see compliance and information assurance driving that budget. But we need to get these skill sets in there. You need to look at it. We're clearly showing you that we're way behind in the healthcare sector. Stop the bleeding, right? Check and make sure SMB isn't open. As simple as it sounds, I mean, look at the exposure. Look at the information attacker can get on your systems through this. It's significant. It's your medical devices that have to do with patient safety's issues. And resilience testing, right? Red teaming, start working on building out those programs and really, you know, harden those edge devices. Don't leave them wide open if you are a large healthcare organization or any organization without any type of password. So please take a look at those. What do we need from healthcare? Kind of talked on that. You know, it's internal programs focused on medical device security. We really need to start looking at that.
you need to start requiring security testing during your vendor selection, and we'll talk about that a little bit later and how you can implement that into your procurement and your vendor selection process. And really, how do you tie that in, and how do you get the win inside of a healthcare organization? Well, you've got to tie it to your mission. You've got to tie it to patient safety. That's what the board level, that's what the executives are going to care about. And it definitely, when it's talking about security of medical devices, is tied to that mission.
So has anyone in here ever heard of a MDS-2 form?
Nope. All of them healthcare
people
never heard of
that. A couple folks. That's good. So an MDS-2 form is a form that came, I think, out of HIMSS. It's been around for several years. Basically, it goes through some really good, almost a checklist function. There is a place for that about authentication and, you know, how accounts are used. And big vendors, major vendors, will have that form on hand for their systems. That's something which you should be asking your vendors for. And then there's recently been some updates and addendums to that. And I think that's a great form that to start to build on. And then, of course, you know, we need to have more responsible disclosure. And then, you know, HHS and OCR, bringing in law enforcement, because this will be moving into a criminal realm, I think. You know, people watch Homeland. There's a lot of sexiness of these attacks that's appealing to, you know, some of these demented personalities out there. So I think it's a possibility. And now, really, one of the more interesting things that I've seen coming over the past year has been some healthcare organizations are bringing in indemnification clauses into their contracts. So what that means is, you know, security and biomedical need to get with legal in the organization and then push back on the vendors and say, well, if something, you know, really bad does happen here, then, you know, who's going to own the liability on this?
All right, so disclosure reporting, this is pretty easy. DHS, ICS CERT, kind of the agencies, manufacturer if possible. I say if possible because this example that I'm about to give you, they won't return any of my calls. I want to responsibly disclose it, but they won't talk to me or get back to me. Apparently, they haven't got back to DHS either because I have not heard anything. Healthcare organizations, you know, you probably should go to your manufacturer first. If you feel they're not responding, know that it will take time, but if you feel they're not working on it, not addressing it, you know, we need to start looking at sending those over to ICS CERT as well as the FDA. Accessibility of medical devices. I think, Sean, you can kind of talk to the stereotypical why people don't get into research involving medical devices.
Sure. So, you know, they're really hard to get a hold of, right? So one of the things is, you know, these are Rx only. They're prescription only, and they're also very expensive. You're not going to go out there and buy a radiology machine. You may not even, well, you can't get the permit for it. You know, there's a lot of hurdles to jump on this. And then you see, if you look at the security researchers over the past years who have been working on this, they've been hacking their own devices, right? So which also brings in a whole nother level of personal ownership and credibility to this, because they're not just security researchers, they're patients. But you know, you can buy these off of eBay. You can go right online right now, and even though it's against eBay's technical terms of services to sell medical devices, they sell them on there, just like you can buy a fake Cisco router off of eBay and have been able to do that for years. MedWow is another site. But here's the problem with that. You know, these have already been end-of-lifed. They're recalled. It's not current running software, so it's not really attacking the actual current software. And then the other thing is, you know, there's going to be a lot of, this is a whole ecosystem that we continue to talk about. So there's going to be, you know, components that you're going to need to have to get that device even up and running and get an IP network and an IP address and networked to even, you know, start to develop an attack service. You want to talk about the consultant stuff?
Yeah, so consulting is, I mean, obviously, if you're not doing independent research and buying it, you're, in a lot of cases, historically, you're going to end up in NDA. But we're starting to see, we've had a few clients that will give access to non-identifiable data clauses so that we can talk about it openly in non-descriptive fashions. So we're starting to see that. I think there's more push to that and more coordination in disclosure. So now that Sean kind of talked about, you know, hey, this is why people don't get involved in security research. We can't get our hands on the devices. I'm going to give you a use case here that will hopefully paint the picture that, you know what, you may not need your hands on these devices. A different way to think. We need more people looking at these issues. I can't do it by myself. So please take a look at this. One of the things is obviously service technician manuals. They contain a lot of information that I'll show you here, full architectural diagrams. Another thing is you can always do patent searches. Manufacturers love to put all the details in their patent application so that nobody steals their idea or uses it. So start doing that. I'm going to show you an example here of how that works. And it's going to be on the DFIPS, right? So there's the vendor name. It's Zoll. This specific one's on an X series. I'll get into some more later on. But these are DFIPS. They're on the public IP space. They sit in an ambulance. They have like a 12-volt lead. And then they transmit all of that back to the ED before arrival. So here they are sitting on public IP space. They're running Verizon because they're running those cellular networks. Well, there's also a web interface. So let's go to the web interface, right? Oh God, I need a certificate. Great, root certificate right on the landing page. Let's download it. Awesome security, right? Well, it's also the first DFIB. And just out of disclosure, I've never actually had my hands on this device. So I'm doing this to paint the picture of the documentation. So wireless, it uses UART for communication into these systems. The communication processor talks back to the main system board. So that's the architectural diagram right there. So it's on the same circuit with receive and transmit. In order to import config, here's your config file out of the documentation that you need to import in order to change the configuration settings. All right, what are the critical values that I'd need to change? What would an attacker need to change to cause patient harm, right? Well, these are critical values. As you can see, two are logging, turned off by default. Default patient mode. Okay, here's some values inside of those configuration files. If I change that adult to one that's set for pediatric to adult, it's going to change the default like jewels that are delivered from that DFIB. You need to do factory restores, right? Well, it says here, oh, I need an authorized supervisor passcode. Well, here's how you get to it through the supervisor menu. As you can see, once you get to the supervisor menu, there's all the config settings. Many of those relate back to the critical settings that I just showed you. So we still have the issue of how do we get into the supervisor mode. Oh, there's your password. 1234. So that's how we, also you can clear logs. So you can completely wipe any traces of this happening. Before I get to this next slide here, I need to just say that I've reached out to this manufacturer numerous times. They won't return my calls. I feel I've responsibly disclosed this. They have not gotten back to us. And so here are every one of Zoll's DFIBs, supervisor creds for every one of their product lines.
Scott, you will have your CBE by the end of the day.
Awesome. Here we go. There they are. Throw the CVEs. There you go, 8-0-1-2-3-4. So vendors changing, yeah, they're getting better, other than that one apparently won't reach out. So I'll let Baby Cares reach out to us. We're working with them. And I want to get a huge shout out here to Philips really quick. I actually went in and worked with them completely pro bono. They invited me in to look at vulnerability disclosure. And they've given me an official statement that they are going to work on this. And so this is their positioning. They're going to come out with vulnerability disclosure policy that's going to be front and center for responsible disclosure on their website so that as a researcher, you can actually go report these easily and even inside the healthcare organization so you don't have the disconnect with biomed. So I want to give them a big hand for that. So look for that. There's other organizations going to be doing that. And lastly, you know, how can you help us? If you're into Android, iOS research, we want to look at application security and mobile device security. We're also looking with further collaboration on physician and patients. So if you're interested in that, get a hold of us. Finally, last, you know, greets to all these guys, man. You know, one, for inspiring us, two, for helping us out and collaborating with us. And, you know, the federal agencies have been great, the support's been great there, as well as, you know, these two manufacturers. There's other manufacturers that are reaching out, not specifically on this talk, but it's getting a lot better. So thank you guys for coming. Have a good day.
Thank you.